Yeah, well, that's, I mean, that's how I get by, like, at work. I never know the answer to a question. I know who to get the answer to a question.
Yeah.
And,
yeah, or what question to ask, get the answer, which is...
Yeah. And I can usually puzzle my way through it, but, you know, I definitely value, you know, the programmers that I can go to and say, hey, why is it doing this? Oh, because, you know, in case blah, 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 we change the logic to this. Brilliant. That's exactly what I need. I don't have that.
Yeah.
You know, if I had it, I could be much more efficient.
That's also most, at least of the Java programmers I know, maybe three of them actually code from scratch. And I know a fair number. And this is also something I've heard that.
As opposed to?
Just taking bits of code that other people have already written and compiling that and maybe tweaking a thing or two because you understand the language.
Right. I was going to say, I mean, if you're using Java, you're always using
defined scratch,
some
right?
You're using a library at some point.
Yeah.
But I see what you're saying, yeah. Yeah, well, that's, you know, that's kind of the difference between, you know, the good old difference between the hackers and the script kiddies, right? You know, there's people who actually understand computer science and can do novel things with it.
Yeah.
And then there's people who can take what they do and understand it just enough to shoot themselves in the foot with it.
Yeah.
And some other people, too. Anyway, but trivia.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's trivial. That's why they call it trivia.
Yeah. Well, he doesn't view it as trivia. But it seems like anything that we view as excess information, which is what causes information overload, is trivial.
I mean, there's a couple different qualities of the word information, and there's a sense in which trivia is very low information.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And I just kind of want to get at what is it that makes a fact informational in the classic, maybe not classic, classics is not this, is information.
Mm-hmm. I think it's how much it either supports or tears down the system of knowledge you already have in place. And so if you get a fact assuming fact as being a proven thing, that tears down your system of knowledge and disproves some of the viewpoints you've had in a very real way, in a very heavy way, then that's pretty high information. But if it kind of makes you question it for a second and then move on, that's pretty low information. Or maybe you're just blocking it.
What if it corroborates?
Well, then if it really gives you another foot to stand on, like if it's something you would bring up at a dinner party to support your argument, then, or put into an academic paper to support it.
That can still be something to be low information to you and you utilize it because it's high information to someone else.
Yeah.
I like the idea that information is associated with change. Which is what I heard you saying, in a way. You know, that high information things cause more change, and low information things cause less change. But anyway, there's a lot of ways to, I mean, there's a lot of ways to define information. There's, you know, Shannon's classical definition of information, which is more about what it means to gain information or lose information,
yeah.
Mathematically speaking.
That's kind of more.
You'll have to explain it to me.
I don't know the math the most, but it's just... Oh, man, it's been a while.
It's related to the number. It's related to what a message can mean. But
I'm just trying to remember pieces of it.
Well, I'll just poke in.
Give it back rigorously because I don't. Because it's really, really pretty. And I don't have it.
It's okay. Well, how would you explain it?
Well, you have to understand that Shannon's theory of information is related to Shannon's theory of information isn't in a lot of ways isn't information the way that we call it, or but usually use it. Like Shannon was describing the transmission of something over a channel, right, with noise, and there's a transmitter and a receiver, and there's a set of things which the signal can mean, and then there's the thing that the signal does mean. Mm-hmm. And and it involves a lot of mechanics related to how does it leave the transmitter meaning one thing and then get received at the receiver meaning the same thing, and that's how you get into like error checking bits and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't necessarily have anything to do with what we would call like information in the sense of, you know, wow, that empowers me to act. That is something that happens, well, from a constructivist point of view, what Shannon was talking about was a signal.
Mm-hmm.
And ways of transmitting signals.
Mm-hmm.
And I can receive a signal, and that signal can produce a change in me. And you can receive the same signal, and it doesn't do anything. So, from a constructivist point of view, the information in the sense of being empowering happens when I do something with that signal, when that signal causes me to make a decision or to do, you know, to do something.
Regardless of if it's the message that was originally sent?
Right. Really, quite regardless of anything Shannon would have to say about the signal at all.
I've often been of the opinion, actually for a long time, I don't even want to say often, I've been of the opinion that it doesn't matter how brilliant you are, if you cannot convey your ideas, it doesn't matter. And so that's, to me, that's information, is a new idea to whoever is receiving it that they can receive and that it changes the way that they view the world or that they act in the world.
Right.
And so then, sorry, keep going.
Oh, no, I was taking it out.
And then to go back to the Twitter idea of me Twittering, I'm in the kitchen, even if you receive that, if it does not change the way that you are acting in the world, then it's not information to you. But if I have friends coming over to dinner that are waiting to hear when I'm home and starting to cook, it's information to them.
Right. And that it also, I think importantly, in that sense, assumes a context.
Yeah.
That without that context, the same message means two different things.
I'm overusing Twitter, or I'm getting a message across.
Right. I think that going in line with that, like Norbert Wiener's thing was control as a subset of communication. So it's not really a novel idea now, but it was when he came up with it. So the idea is, and he worked with Shannon. So his idea was, I give you a message that's intended to make you do something that I want you to do. And then, and I inform that message based on what I know about you. And that speaks to people who are able to, I mean, there's a Heinz von Forrester said something that I liked. He said the listener, not the speaker, determines the meaning of an utterance.
Oh yeah.
Right. You can say what you want, and it's always up to the other person what they do with that. But where feedback is involved is I can take what I know of you and I can craft the message in such a way that that based on my knowledge of you, it has a higher expectation of getting you to do what I want you to do. And that's how we get into like influence and persuasion and manipulation and things like that. But Norbert's thing was all control as a subset of communication. And so so there's my message to you, and then there's your response to that message, which then informs my subsequent message to you. Like, mm-hmm. which is either, okay, I have to change my message because clearly you're not doing what I want you to do, or I give you some kind of a message of approval. Oh, good job. Well, you're doing my will. mm-hmm. Or something like
that's
that.
That's very nice. Yeah.
I think what I was trying to go with information in the other sense is we require so very little context and so very little, well, this is what I mean, not very much disambiguation, and so a lot of our ideas have to be these chunks that can float around, and you don't have to have a whole lot of information to be able to interpret them. They just have to mm-hmm. be sort of self-contained pockets of thought. And there's a lot of complex thought that requires more ambiguity and more context and more a bigger shape. And I'm just not sure that these memes have the same meat.
When writing papers in college, I hated it when the instructors gave the instruction, that you had to act as if the person reading it had no prior knowledge of the subject. And it just drove me nuts, because then it's like, I will spend two paragraphs on explaining something that I know you know about, instead of using those two paragraphs to go more deeply into the subject. Why are you taking up my space?
And well, and how far do you take that? Like, how much do they not know? Can we start with they speak English?
So, we live on Earth, two pages later.
Yeah.
There are these things called essays. This is what you are reading. Okay, now I proceed.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, that would drive me crazy, too.
It's okay.
You cut off.
It's like, what, there's glass?
It's a good thing that we're fishing. It's gonna be swimming. You sleep with the fishes, see? I fish in my room, I sleep with them. So not like that. I know. No, I completely lost my train of thought.
You were talking about being irritated about the length of the essays you had to write when there was no context.
Yeah. And I think that's one thing that influences how much information you're able to take in. Like, because I've been reading Overcoming Bias for long enough, I finally understand a lot of the stuff that's going on the blog. Whereas when I first jumped in, I was like, I have no idea. But I just started reading, even though I didn't understand it, until it came to a point where I did understand it. And I like blogs that assume you have some idea of what's going on, even a deeper knowledge, in order to get their new ideas, instead of starting from scratch every time, because everything on there seems to have, even if I don't agree with it, has a lot of depth to it.
Right. Well, that's what distinguishes an academic textbook from not academic. That they're able to make the assumption that you know a lot of things already, so they can get into the more technical things and the more complex things, and then, as opposed to having to say, okay, math, there's a thing called a number. You know. I appreciate people who are able to communicate complex ideas simply, usually using metaphor and things like that. I really value that. I also like it, though, when somebody doesn't feel the need to dumb down what they're saying. I like it when somebody expects you to step up to their level of knowledge. Mm-hmm. Right? I kind of admire
that.
Yeah,
where the knowledge matching is done on the listener side, so that you're always jumping where you need to, asking it to be pulled down when you need to, but there's never this point where it's unnecessarily pulled down.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Or it's okay to read an academic blog all day and then, or set of blogs, and then go to I Can't Ask Cheeseburger for a couple of minutes to kind of give your brain a rest and then go back to it.
Right. I mean, the first time I read Cybernetics, I understood like maybe 10% of it. It was so far above my head. I was like a sophomore in high school when I read that. And I had no idea what a differential equation was. And not only that, but there was so much lingo that never was even. Had no idea, but I made myself read it because, the 10% I did get, I just felt was profoundly important and beautiful, and it gave me a reason to learn more. You know, I thought, well, I really want to know what this guy is talking about, so now I have to go read some other books and stuff.
Exactly, with the first steps of beginning to read, I mean. We push so much having perfection and being able to get 90% of whatever you're reading that there are kids out there who the experience of learning to read is difficult, not because it's unenjoyable, but because they're aware that they are only catching 10%, and in that their minds that equals failure.
Right.
And just to have it be okay to be drowning.
As long as you're still swimming for the surface.
Yeah. Well, as long as the goal is to be learning in that sense and not...
Yeah.
You know.
It's a good thing to have to try, which is going to mean failure sometimes.
A lot.
Yeah. So how do... Theoretically, how... Do you encourage people to actually figure out what is important to them and how to pursue the, I don't want to say deeper meanings, because you can analyze anything until it's, because we construct it, you can find infinite meaning in it because we're all very complex and blah, blah, blah. But, I mean, how can we encourage people, or how could we personally remember to look for deeper things or look for more complex interpretations of something? Or
I think those are two different things. I think a person's ability to, not unrelated things maybe, I think a person's ability to figure out for themselves what they want is not necessarily the same as a person's ability to contemplate something, right?
Mm-hmm.
And to learn something in depth. I think the first thing is, my answer to that may sound fluffy, but I think it really comes down to teaching people how to listen to themselves. Like teaching people how to listen to the little voice in their gut or their head or their intuition or whatever. Because I think that, from my own experience personally, I think that there aren't any ultimate answers to that sort of question, the question of what's really meaningful to you, beyond people that at some level just have to make that call for themselves. And then encouraging people encouraging people to think things through by asking the tough questions. You know, by having blogs where, you know, not everything is brought down to an easy to digest little morsels of stuff, because you're going to lose stuff in that in that translation.
Do resolution.
I know all of my good, all of my favorite teachers were people who one, taught me to think for myself, and B, taught me to ask legitimate questions, which were questions that I don't know the answers to about whatever it is that I'm studying. You know, don't just look for corroboration. Don't just look to, you know, don't look to be an expert. Don't just look to find the information that's going to prove me right. Look for the information that's going to prove me wrong, and then argue with myself about that.
Yeah.
And that kind of stuff.
There's the question of, why am I seeking out this information? And then there's, how am I reading it, or what am I looking for while I'm reading? And I don't think I can come up with a single answer for the reason that I can think of a counterexample where my bigger goal is different than my goal while reading. I wanted to learn how to read more technical information, and so I set about to reading technical manuals with that 10% thing, and just while I was reading the technical manual, though, if my goal was, well, I just want to get better at reading technical manuals, I would never have gotten better.
Mm-hmm.
My goal while doing that was drop down a level to, I want to know how this typewriter works, because I'm going to, I remember I did it with like a sewing machine, and it was, I was going to repair the sewing machine, but I wasn't actually, but by having that as my goal, I was able to then read it for as much comprehension as my 10% brain could. And so if your goal is to, I guess the thing is just the idea that there can be meta goals while getting information, that it's okay to have your goal when you're sitting down and reading a book to be, I want to be able to still sit down and read a book one day.
For me, that's, there's a Faithless line, because this is a band that I like.
What's the next suggestion?
Oh, yes. Where it's, tomorrow has to start somewhere. And I remember actually being in the bathtub in 7th grade and realizing, holy shit, if I want to get all this stuff done, I have to start now, because it's not just going to happen. And so then by setting smaller goals for myself, of like, I want to repair this sewing machine, and so I'm going to read this technical manual to get it done, which is not something I did, but as an example, then in the long term, if my goal had been processing really thick informational manuals, then just figuring out where your, what matters, what the end point is, but then also figuring out what smaller chunks are feasible in the meantime. What can I accomplish today that will still reach that goal? And what have I done today that still goes towards that? You know, I can have a really lazy day as long as it's maintaining my mental health so that I can still do something tomorrow. So,
Bruce Lee said, one thing every day that's, you know, that's moving towards what it is that you want. But, I mean, that's just, that's a classic way of dealing with complexity, though, right? Just breaking it down into smaller things.
But I think we have, I don't want to say more complexity, but more opportunity to access complexity now.
Sure.
That level of focus becomes more important. But at the same time, you have to gain the ability to process the complexity.
There's a similar thing happening in design culture. There was a TED talk from John Maeda, or I'm probably mangling his name, M-A-E-D-A, anyway, about simplicity and complexity and how we're just hardwired to love complexity, even though he does these gloriously simple designs.
Mm-hmm.
I think in the same way that the design community is polarized between just this Rococo complex and really, really minimalist simple, we're getting sort of polarized between complex, rich information, yay, internet good, and no, oh my god, overload, internet bad.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be nice to have a dialogue about just managing complexity or something middler.
Most of the techie people I know, and I think that this also has a lot to do with the way Seattle is laid out and how green it is, but the techie people I know are also the people that love to go camping and that love to just shut off for a little while. And I think that a lot of people are starting to realize how to deal with all that information and how to... taking a step back, at least personally, reminds me what's important. Because otherwise I get on wild tangents and get really passionate about something, and then I'm like, what am I doing? This doesn't matter, you know?
Sure. Yeah, well, it gives you time to digest and assimilate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just much like sleeping, if you said something. I think there's a lot of things that our brains and bodies do with information that aren't as obvious as, you know, as what happens when you're actively engaged in acquiring information, as if information is something that can be acquired, but you know what I mean?
That's it, yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe that's something to add to it, is that we do have a back burner, and we tend to think of information, well, just because it's the process of our day, you tend to think of acquiring information as what happens while you're there absorbing information, and then it's done, and other things happen. But I mean, this is taking it in, and then there's a whole bunch of processing and back burner stuff. And elevating the back burner stuff, I mean, just because it's not in your frontal lobe doesn't mean it's not happening.
Yeah.
I also think this may be getting a little ephemeral, but I think there's a sense at which it also happens beyond you. Like, in the conversations that you're having with people, they're continuing to process
the continually
information
bump up
that
against
you're involved
it.
With. Yeah.
Yeah, this is sometimes where you have the, I don't know if I agree with that. Give me a second, and then you just hold the worldview, and does it still work? And,
Or even through this conversation, like, I can have a question, and next week, Willow will answer that question for me.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's like when you're looking to buy a house, and all of a sudden you see houses for sale everywhere. It's because it's what you're thinking about that you suddenly pick out that bit of information of all the things that are available to you in the world. So, do you think that this is a viable topic? As a presentation thing?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I think there's...
What
be responsible for your own information, and here are some tools, and...
Mm-hmm.
Can I ask, what's this presentation making for your friend?
Oh!
referring to?
It's a secret presentation!
Yeah. You know, thinking about submitting to Ignite Seattle. But she will, of course, be credited if we end up doing it, because you gave us brands.
I have one more thing about information diets that I want to mention. When we talk about information, we talk a lot about filtering the information that's coming along.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking today about another aspect of that being limiting how much we hold ourselves to be responsible sources of other people's information.
I can't take much more information in because I really have to pee.
Okay.
Do you want to continue or do you want to wait until she gets
back? I can go ahead.
Okay.
I can talk to her. No. There's nothing to talk about.
Yeah, there's this really gorgeous building. Hello!
Hi!
There's this really gorgeous building on my flock to the Lord Studio that is gorgeous blue-gray and gray-blue that most of the time one of the two will match the sky.
Mm.
It's really cool. I'm pleased with those architects.
For some reason that reminded me. There's a building in New York City, in the skyscrapers, that has the like mirrored glass all over it, but it's done in such a way that during a certain time of day from a certain angle, the building almost disappears. It almost becomes transparent as it's reflecting one part of the sky that just looks like it's part of the sky behind the building.
Mm-hmm. It's always so magical. I really enjoy architecture that actually influences the environment around it in some way and becomes art. There was a really cool part of the library in Bloomington that reflected the rising sun so that it hit the west wall of a building. And so you'd be walking along and all the light of them, well, I guess it was the opposite, but that direction. So all of the morning red light would be on one side of all these buildings, and then you would come across one square that was being reflected that was on the opposite side.
Yeah.
Because the architect would work with someone else or something to kind of create this mirrored effect, and it was just... I love playing with the environment around you because it's... And like the connecting tunnels in Seattle and how organic it makes it feel, because you know you can get from 6th and Union down to 4th and University without ever hitting light and stuff like that. But we tangent into architecture while you were in the restroom. Yes. Please continue.
So for example, today I was thinking, as part of all of this information-y stuff, you know, I participate in these conversations, and I'm helping some friends build a website, and I'm trying to help, you know, I'm adding Phil Farber as an administrator on the Facebook page for his talk so that he can mass email everybody and say, come to my gig, and you know, I'm replying to 50 personal emails a day and 50 work emails a day and stuff. And just thinking about the idea that part of an information diet should be me making limits on how much I'm going to be sources of other people's information. Like, do I really need to Twitter everybody? Do I really need to, you know, respond to all of these email messages? Do I really need to build these many websites and whatnot? And maybe what's good for me is to put limits on those things, you know, which is kind of a dieting idea. You know, and know when to tell people, you know what, I can't commit to that. Know when people don't need to, well, first of all, I don't Twitter at all. Because, I mean, I've been on there for a long time. I just, nothing ever happens to me that I think, wow, everybody in the fucking world needs to know this about me. It just never happens. And
sorry.
maybe I either undervalue my coolness, or maybe I'm just not that cool. I don't know. Now, if there are things where, like, if I'm like, I want to let people know, hey, there's something coming up. You know, for example, I'm trying to get the Phil Farber thing out there so we get people, you know, coming to attend the event. So, like, I've put that on my Gmail, you know, little blurb thing. Like, you will often put it. I'll do stuff like that, and that, to me, has a practical value. But I don't know. Am I being coherent at all?
Yes. Yeah.
You know, I was just thinking that we're so often thinking about these diets in terms of what we're taking in. What about also thinking about what we're getting out?
Yeah.
And
sources of information. Yeah.
And you know, being responsible to produce quality information and not just expunge everything that comes up in the course of our day. I mean, it's getting, you know, having clothes that, you know, handbags that Twitter our friends, and and stuff like that is really ridiculous to me. Like, I mean, what I love about that stuff is the potential to do meaningful, cool stuff with that technology.
Yeah.
You know, people using, you know, Twitter networks to organize events or to...
Yeah. Or to figure out if their restaurant line is long. That's one of my favorites.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's great stuff like that, but, yeah, you know, I go on Facebook and there's, like, you know, all my friends who I love dearly, it's like, you know, I just saw this movie, I just got home from work, I'm taking a nap, I just figured out which fucking Harry Potter character I am, or, you know, like,
yeah,
what?
Yeah.
Okay.
I just sign on every 3 weeks to see if there are any long-lost friends. And once every 3 weeks, there are a few. And then I say, hi, I'm never actually on here. Here's my other information and go away.
Yeah,
Go
ahead.
Oh, just what about... I really like how that sinks into your information, content, and responsibility. The way we were talking about earlier, not just saying, this is some information, but saying, and here's where I got it, or, and this is why I think it, or, and this is... You know,
love that idea.
Like when I give somebody instructions or somebody asks me for advice, I say, and here's how well it worked for me.
As long as you do it
like,
with that sound effect.
Yeah, you've got to give sound effects with the advice. It's very important.
I think it's also important to be creating something to give back that has meaning. And that will be relevant to people. I mean, Libby posts about ways to cook food, and she posts on how to take better photographs, and sharing that information so then someone can build on top of it and make
that's
it better,
great.
And that she can learn from that.
I have a pretty low-tolerance fact bucket. I'll take, like, 2, maybe 3 factual questions, and then I'll be like, so, you want to learn more about this? I'm going to help you learn more about it by providing it. And then I give a skill, or you... Here are all the resources that I learned my stuff from.
And what's fun about that is then people take away something different from it, and then you can discuss it with them instead of just imposing your view on it.
Yeah, and that's how you get to learn.
Learning, I think, needs to be emphasized more.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like, not just sharing information, but learning, doing something.
This is my roommate Christine, by the way. This is Joshua.
You've
already met Colleen.
Does it count as learning if what I'm learning is how many weird Twitter experiments I can pull before my friends pull me off of their Twitter?
Sure.
I may be learning that soon.
I'm going to stick through it.
That's awesome. After this week, it's going to be only sounds. I'm Twittering everything I hear.
Okay. I can deal with that. I can do that. I like to give a wide variety of things. And I try to warn when I'm going to use it for planning purposes.
Yeah, there will be a weekly warning, followed by a smattering of whatever I feel like doing for the week.
I approve.
Anyway.
Okay. Are we good for a little bit?
I'm always good. Makes sense.
Oh. Ask you to let me know how it goes with the 50 emails, but then that would...